This week in Retronauts, here's a helping of discursive seconds. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I am here with other people to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Nintendo DS. And I have summoned an all-star rogues gallery of people who have opinions about the Nintendo DS. But just a word of warning, before we get going, we've already done an anniversary episode for the Nintendo DS 10 years ago, back when it was only 10.
Yes.
Now that we are twice that distance away, but that old episode is still in our current catalog and easily accessible to anyone who has access to Retronauts, such as on patreon.com/retronauts, or on your favorite podcatcher of choice besides Spotify because they are evil. We don't need to cover that same territory. We need to do something a little different. See what I did there? DS, yeah. That's good, good. So this is going to be more akin to our Sega Dreamcast anniversary episode that Diamond and I recently recorded, although more people showed up for this one than Diamond, which, you know, makes sense because the Nintendo DS was massively more successful than the Sega Dreamcast, and therefore it follows that more people would want to talk about it. So who do I have here talking about the Nintendo DS with me? Let's do the proximity thing. We'll go up to Maryland, out in Crabtown.
A bit of a damp squid, Kevin Bunch.
Damp squid or squib?
Well, squib is the correct one, but the joke was squid.
Right, DS, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, if a squid is merely damp, it has some problems. Mm. Further up north, we have...
You probably have Nadia Oxford, and my DS joke is the DS stands for, do not steal games, please. Do not...
Or delete after 24 hours.
Everyone did the end. Good pod, everyone.
All right, and heading east, we have the person who just chimed in.
Oh, yeah, hello. Damn Skippy, I am Double Stuff, Stuart Jerp, and I am deemed suitable for this podcast.
That's
for
the
some
best
reason.
That's the best ESRB rating you can get, deemed suitable.
Rated E for your mom is my favorite, though. No, it's rated E for everyone, like your mom. That's it.
Finally, over in Osaka.
Ah, my diamond sense is tingling. Yes, Diamond Fight is here, and happy to be here. I guess this would make this podcast our Dreamcast successor.
Oh
my
shit.
God!
That's a good one. Winner.
All right, hang it up, folks. We can't beat that. Or can we? I guess we'll find out.
There's
going to
be a lot of those,
half or so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Actually, I'm going to forget all about this stuff and just talk about the DS. I say, I'm probably lying. Anyway, so the Nintendo DS, 20 years old. And actually, when it first showed up, everyone agreed with Kevin that it seemed like a damp squid. It was a damn sight headed for failure, that's for sure.
Downward spiral.
Downward spiral. That's really what it seemed like, yes.
You know, 2 hours
Nintendo
of this.
Especially.
I was thinking about
Nintendo
this,
was in a bad place.
Yeah, Jeremy, I was thinking about this, especially in the context of our last episode where we talked about how the Dreamcast was, you know, one of the last, if not the last, consoles to launch, you know, in Japan, significantly earlier in Japan before coming to the other countries. First of all, DS launched in America before it launched in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And second
Which
of
might
all,
have been a first for a Japanese system.
And the other thing I thought of was, like, this is one of the first, if maybe only, Nintendo systems I can think of where it launched... And I was like, no, I'm not, I don't want that at all, no. And it wasn't until its remodel came out almost like a year and a half later where I was like, oh, now I'm sold.
Yeah.
But like the initial period, the initial offering, if you will, I was looking at them like, no, I don't, what is, what the hell is that? Like, it's, I guess, you know, perhaps it was motivated by, you know, the company's dire straits, but,
wow.
It's just,
you know, I'm just going to make a sound effect anytime someone does that. It's going
to
get really
annoying. Out the door, you know, but it's just like that original DS, you know, the so-called fat, if you will. I don't know. It just,
when they showed
that rub me the wrong
at
way.
At E3, was it? Yeah. It was like, I'm like, oh my God, that's kind of ugly as hell.
Oh, the prototype version was chunky and cheap looking and really weird. Like, the original launch model was actually very elegant compared to the initial test version, which looked like if, you know, Tiger Electronics had put that out, they would have sent it, shipped it with an apology. Like, we're really sorry about this. It was bad. But yeah, the light really changed people's perception of the DS. And when I think about the light, I think about actually the fact that that was my first ever magazine cover story for Pocket Games.
Oh, nice.
And Nadia and I basically wrote that episode or that issue entirely by ourselves. It's like, if you have it, it's a great, great looking magazine. It's got this blue cover and the D is like with a kind of a background in the, like an environmental background, like nature or something. And then the white DS light is just right there. And the entire magazine is just full of the two of us saying, "Hey, this is cool.
Did I write
you should
that?
Play it.
I don't
it.
Even remember
Good
that.
Games.
Holy shit. I must be fried."
I'm positive that you contributed a ton to that magazine. I haven't actually flipped through it because
I missed that magazine. I miss writing for magazines.
No. The cover feature was the one I wrote, but you contributed a ton of stuff about the games and it, like, just kind of the catch-all overall feature.
Oh, I remember that.
Because it was a feature issue on the DS Lite. Because what else was there at the time? PSP, who cared about that?
There wasn't a lot going on. Yeah, it was like, maybe that's part of the reason it took off. One thing I'll get into later is how that was the system for RPGs at the time, whereas consoles were like, RPGs, this is so weird in Japanese. And I'm sure we'll get into that.
Mm-hmm.
So, Diamond, where were you when the DS launched? Were you still living in the US or had you moved to Japan by that point?
When the original DS launched, I was still in America. And, yeah, I was very much, I've told the story of the episodes, but the short version is, when the DS came out, I was very much like, oh boy, new video games don't seem to be for me anymore. Mm. Everyone's all about 3D. I'd rather enjoy my older games. You know, I still had a Neo Geo. I still had, I still was playing Dreamcast in 2004. So, you know, I was sort of in a weird spot where I kept reading new stories, but I was like, oh, this doesn't look good. Or I'd buy a new game and half the time I'd be disappointed. So I let it sort of sit there like, okay, well, whatever this DS is, I don't need it, you know? And then I even poo-pooed the Game Boy Micro, which was a mistake because now I really want one. But eventually when the light came out, I had actually been to Japan and come back. And so when I came back from Japan as a student, having finished my study abroad, I was like, oh, geez, this new DS is out, and oh my God, it looks great. So I got one really early on after returning from Japan, and I was playing it a lot around New York City. So then I was playing it up at school, and a lot of my fellow students at college, they also had their DSs around too. And one of the things that happened right away was we all picked up on the fact that, A, there was a lot of software for it that wasn't just games, and B, there was a huge import market for it. Because, you know, at the time,
I would say that was the last system that really had a thriving import scene. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, Nintendo went out of its way to block imports with the DSi. But at that point, you know, there was this big influx of software from Japan. And in particular, for people like us, you know, at that point, this is like, you know, with the mid-aughts, you know, a lot of students, especially Japanese students, a lot of us would go out and we'd buy these little sort of like electronic, you know, dictionaries that we could look up kanji and look up readings. And it was, you know, there were obviously lots of paperback, you know, editions, but these digital versions were much more, you know, convenient. But the DS, of course, the DS, you know, had an electronic screen, also had a touch screen, which means with the right software, you could literally write a kanji and have the software look it up for you. So
Goodness for touch dick.
Yeah. And so a lot of us in our, you know, at my college and in my classes, we were using our DSs collectively as a dictionary substitute. And I feel like that was just, you know, I don't know if they were making money off that or not, but like, amongst us in the nerd community, we were all over that.
Yeah, I had that same sort of setup with one of those dictionaries, because I remember asking a friend of mine who was living in Tottori at the time if she could pick up some DS games for me and send them to me. So she did, so she sent me a copy of, was it Ketsui? And for whatever reason, she included a Japanese to kanji dictionary, and wow, that thing was extremely helpful when I was studying Japanese in college. Not as fun as Ketsui, but what is?
So, where were you when the DS launched?
I was in college, I guess. And I was not initially enthused about the DS either, because the launch library for it just seemed very, shall we say, lackluster. Yeah. So I just sort of kind of ignored it for, I don't know, the first year and a... Well, the first, like, half a year or so. A couple of friends of mine had theirs. I got to mess with them a little bit. Was not particularly interested. But then they finally put together, like, a bundle of it with Super Mario 64 through, I think, was it Walmart or something? And then at that point I thought, okay, well, it's got a game with it, and it's a game I know I reasonably enjoy, so I'll pick it up there.
You're just totally erasing Metroid Prime Hunter's first hunt right there. Was that not a game?
It was a something.
It was a very interesting demo. But yeah, I don't even particularly like that Mario 64 port, but that was enough to get my foot in the door on that system.
I'd love to see that remade for the Switch. It was like such a really interesting upgrade to Mario 64, and then they released it on a system that didn't have two analog controllers or any analog controllers, and
they gave you the thumb nub.
I tried that thing. It just did not work.
It was awful.
It was terrible.
I did not like that.
It was,
there's no optimal way to play that version unless you hack it or something. Yeah. It's just D-pad completely, like, just no touch. Using the stylus, what are you thinking? What are you doing? And the thumb nub, as described, not only is it awful to use, it's also social suicide if anyone sees you.
Yeah, in a way, the DS was very ahead of its time, because that thumb nub really anticipated horrible screen-based controls on mobile platforms, which, you know, it's been 15 years now, and those still suck, and I hate them. But the DS was out there, 5 years ahead of its time, leading the way to digital suckiness. I don't know. I lost it. But yeah, that was such a bad choice. The funny thing is, I don't think Super Mario 64 DS really got good and fun to play until the 3DS came out, and then you could use the analog slider to play. Mm-hmm. And even though it was still digital, like it felt good. Like I remember popping that in early on when the 3DS came out. It was like, oh, well, I don't like this stretchy, horrible thing that it's doing to the graphics, but at least it plays really well, controls well.
And I will go on the record of saying that the Fat DS is the Fat DS is my preferred platform for DS hardware, just because the D-pad just feels so good.
It does.
Compared to
interesting. I did really like because it's Nintendo, released a plethora of alternative colors for the DS pretty soon after its launch. So that initial system was just silver, which is always the worst and most boring color for a game system.
It's like having a silver car.
Yeah.
Why would you do it?
Yeah, like, why? Don't do that. But, you know, then they released, like, blue and red, and they came out with one that was white. And this was before the DS Lite, and that white one was, I don't know, it was really nice. It just seemed, like, five times classier than the normal DS. And there was something about the way the... like the power LEDs kind of glowed within the white plastic that just made it seem very prestigious. So I would show that to people and they'd be like, oh, this is actually a really cool system. And I don't know what it was about the plastics they used in that, but it really turned people's heads. But I do still have a fat DS that someone hacked to get video out of. So I guess if I really need that, I have that access. But for me, my preferred DS model is the DSi XL, which is basically, it's like having a tiny laptop that just plays DS games. Yes. But pixel-based games on that system look so good. Like, you know, all the Game Boy Advance games you can play. Well, I guess you can't play them on that because it doesn't have the slot, too.
Yeah, actually, Jeremy, I'm glad you brought up the XL model, because that was a case of, at first, I remember being really confused. Like when they announced they were going to make a bigger DS, like, wait a second, it's a portable system. Why would you want to make a bigger version of the portable system? But then, like, as soon as I saw it in stores, I was like, oh, wait, actually, this looks kind of good. And I also remember that I think, I want to say within a year of the DS, like the DS Large, it was LL in Japan. It was called XL in America, right?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like within a year of that coming out, Apple announced the iPad. And I was like, wait, did Apple just copy Nintendo? Did they just make a bigger version of their handheld system? And, you know, no one else agreed with me, and I didn't get any traction with that on Twitter. But the point is, it was just a very funny, surprising idea that suddenly we all, you know, these devices that were normally thought of as, you know, small and compact, and that was their selling point. It's like, wait, we'll just make big versions, and everyone wants those too. And we did. We did want big ones. And now,
people wanted it.
Yeah, I absolutely, like, now I look for, like, the biggest phone I could possibly get when I look for
phones. Meanwhile, Atari's out there like, but we gave you the Lynx and you wanted Game Boy instead. What do you want from us? All those years later, just bitterness, just seething. Mm. Terrible. Very sad.
Yeah, it's a damn shame what happened to them.
Yeah, Stuart, what was the DS like, DS launch like over in the UK, or at least for you?
I was like hyped. I was super into this because I didn't have a handheld. As I've mentioned many times, I basically went from Spectrum to PS2. I had a big sort of gap in a smallish gap there, and I was ready for this because I actually had disposable income, like proper disposable income. I was like, I'm going to get me a DS. And I'm going to save up. I'm going to get all those hot games that I want to play, because Super Mario 64. Like, I don't even like Super Mario 64, and I'm like, you can play it on the toilet now. I'm there. I want to. That's the preferred way. And Rayman, terrible port of Rayman 2. I want to play Rayman 2 with a handheld. Are you kidding me? I'm getting that. And a new WarioWare Touched. Again, are you kidding me? I'm having that. And just went kind of mad and got those, and I got Project Rub, or whatever. I think it was called Project Rub. No, it was
Rub Rabbits.
Yes, that's the second one.
Yeah.
It was.
Okay. Yeah, it was Feel the Magic.
Feel the Magic XYXX. And I think out of all of those four, I ended up loving Feel the Magic the most for some reason. There's something about it that I just like.
It's Sega.
But, yeah, because I'm a Sega boy, that's right, yeah. But I was just into it, and I'm just getting yelled at by my friend for touching his screen with my fingers and just showing everyone this cool game where you tap charging balls and being told that's not a game. Like, this, it was, we got to think about it in the context of, like, there were obviously mass market devices with touchscreens, but they were all like, they were for work, you know? And this thing kind of looked a bit like a sort of a PDA sort of thing. You open it up, you get the kind of classy noise that goes doo doo, you know? And then you've got, like, sort of Microsoft Windows-ass-looking interface there, and PictoChat and all that stuff. And, yeah, I was super into it. And, in fact, when it launched, I went to get it, and it had sold out. There were none anywhere in town. And I was so achingly desperate and bereft that I ended up buying a GBA for some reason. And just being told, you're an idiot. And I'm like, no, I'm not an idiot, because I've got Donkey Kong Country 2, and you've got nothing. And, yeah... I was all about it. Everyone seemed to be all about it. Then you get Mario 64 and you open it up and you're like, why am I Yoshi? What the hell is going on? And that first model, I must have put it through the ringer. I think I had to take it back about three times because of dead pixels. There was a huge problem with dead pixels with lot of DS, and I wasn't having any of it. They had this straight kind of exchange program, I think, but I ended up just going back to the same branch of game over and over again, where the scowling manager kept going, it's just one dead pixel. I'm like, I don't care. It's in the middle of the screen and it's red. exchange it. It was an awful shop. I'm glad that they're going under. But no, I mean,
yeah, they deserve it. They don't like your pixels.
I mean, I hope that they land on their feet, the employees, except for that one guy. I hope he dies. But a big draw for me, though, genuinely, was the fact that it had a GBA slot as well, because I'd been playing like the entire GBA library more or less as it released, because it was hugely emulated. It was a big Visual Boy Advance was a big deal in that sort of community. And, you know, beating those games within a day is hard, because you've got to get rid of those ROMs, but I managed it with pretty much all of them.
Of course, otherwise it'd please get you.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm still here today. I'd be locked up if not. But I was just so excited for it, because I had that experience with the GBA and all these sequels that they announced were coming, like Dawn of Sorrow. Are you kidding me? Like, I was all over that. I'm like, come on, let's go. And it was the first system I ever actually like imported anything for, because it was the first handheld. It was region free. I could play those games. I was kind of getting into this burgeoning interest in, I guess, realizing what my tastes were sort of really solidly in Nintendo games, in contemporary handheld games. So I was getting all these, 10 million Mega Man games they brought out for it, the 10 million Hell yeah. Castlevanias. I was all about that. Like Contra 4, what the hell, what's going on? But we'll get more into the library, but it was just a huge one for me. It still is. Like, I mean, it stands like alone almost. I don't think anything before or since has had quite the volume of banger games that came out for the DS. It's just an incredible system.
Yeah, Stu, I'm so glad you mentioned the slot, 3D, the GBA slot, because that was another selling point for me, because I had messed around with the GBA early on, but ultimately I wasn't really impressed by it. And I definitely wasn't impressed by Circle of the Moon, which I've written about as one of my columns. So when I got my DS Lite and I realized that I could play GBA games, I was like, oh, I can catch up on these Castlevania games, because I hear there's new ones out and it sounds like some of them are good. So as soon as I got my DS Lite, that became my Castlevania machine for a while. And I played all the GBA ones. I finished playing the GBA ones. Like, okay, these are better than I expected, the other ones. And then I was playing the DS version, like, Dawn of Sorrow, great. And then by the time Portrait of Ruina came out, I was back at college again. I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And then, of course, Order of Ecclesia was an order better. So
hey,
it was just that, that little slot on there, which, probably cost them extra, a significant amount of resources to put that thing in there. But it also sort of gave me a nice, like, vote of confidence that's like, oh, yeah, don't worry. If there's not a lot of DS games that impress you, there's going to be a ton of GBA games you can go back and try. And that's what I was doing with it for a while, until I was like, oh, well, I'm just going to try more, DS games, like, New Super Mario Brothers and other stuff that just started coming out. And in the end, it worked out perfectly. But for a good chunk there, I was like, oh, this is great. I can catch up on games that I missed.
Yeah, the slot, too, I loved as well, just for a number of reasons. I mean, the whole thing of certain games interacting with GBA games, like Dawn of Sorrow again, Feel the Magic would unlock stuff if you had certain games in the slot. But I also had Guitar Hero on tour, where you would plug it in and
you'd
like strumming this stupid screen, like bottom screen.
I just looking at that, like, I want to press those buttons. Something about those buttons cool. Looks so satisfying.
Yeah, I don't think I even have a system that can use it anymore, but that thing's still kicking around.
That is one of the downsides of the DSi XL, is that it doesn't have the Game Boy Advance slot 2, which means I can't use my Arkanoid spinner on that. One of the goofiest but best little peripherals ever released for a handheld system. It kind of turns your DS into a Milton Bradley Microvision, which had the spinner built into the bottom of the system.
That's what everyone wanted.
It's only good for MDM like two experience. Games, but whatever. It's good for, Arkanoid and Space Invaders.
You've given me an opportunity to complain about something. May I complain about it, please, Jeremy?
Oh, I couldn't possibly stop you, honestly.
No, you couldn't. the Arkanoid sort of analog spinner thing is really cool. And then the version of Arkanoid on the DS is just terrible. It's just so bad and boring. And, like, it's just dreadful. And once you beat it, once you beat like all the 100 terrible boards, you unlock Uranoid, which is a way more fun version of it that should have been the default version. And nobody even knows about it because nobody wants to play through Arkanoid DS for 100 levels. All right, thanks. I would never get another opportunity to bring that up, so I appreciate it.
that kind of ties in with the Famicom version of Space Invaders, which actually had Space Invaders Part 2 in it, but you had to play through a really bad port of Space Invaders to get there. And as it happens, Space Invaders Extreme is also a game supported by the DS Spinner. So
That's awesome.
I think there's a second one too. I think Space Invaders.
Yeah, there is.
So actually, that's three games. Yeah.
Wow.
So that little spinner is definitely worth $200 or $300 for sure.
They should have let you use like Buster Move with it, but no.
You can.
There
is a puzzle bobble game on the DS that uses the spinner because a friend of mine had it and she wanted me to borrow.
I need to track that down.
There's Buster Move DS and there's like Buster Move Galaxy, which is a really good one if memory serves.
Yeah, I forget which one has the support for it. But one
Space
of them does.
Puzzle Bobble or something like that. It was good.
Okay, so it's actually very surprising to hear that in the UK, at least, or at least in Stuart's little bubble of the UK, I don't know which is true,
that
the DS
was
actually highly anticipated and people were very excited about it, because that was not that was not the perception that I took away at the time of the launch, leading up to the launch. And maybe that's because I was in the games journalism bubble by that point, but I don't think so. Like, just looking on forums and just the kind of general chat about DS, no one seemed to understand why they were doing that and what the appeal was. And, you know, people were like, oh, wow, you can put a map on the other screen. How exciting is that? Actually, that's really good and cool, it turns out. But people didn't have the vision at the time. And that includes me. Like, I was like, I don't really know about this. Like, I like Nintendo. I like portable games. But is this necessary? But then, you know, I tried it and was like, oh, this is kind of cool. It's neat. It's not going to last very long. So I'm going to, you know, support it for the next 6 months. And then it's going to go away. And Nintendo's going to go bankrupt. And Microsoft's going to buy them. And, you know, I figured it would be like a sweet little swan song to go down the tubes along with GameCube. And that would be the end of Nintendo. And I'd be there, you know, waving the flag for them to the very bitter end, which clearly shows how prescient I am and how good I am at reading the future of business and the nature of the video games industry, which is why I should be doing Michael Pachter's job, because I'm still better than him.
A wet cardboard box is better than him, frankly.
I don't know if I'd go that far, yes.
Okay. A dry cardboard box, perhaps.
Okay, dry cardboard box, I can accept that.
Yeah, slightly moist, I don't know. I think I may have given an unreasonable sample of the sort of UK reaction to that thing, because, I mean, I was a gamer trash. I was, like, on the forums. I was a piece of shit, you know? It was just, like...
You must have been on the same Mega Man communities as me.
I was on your Mega Man network, or whatever, Mega Man BN or Mega Man N something.
Mega Man
network,
back in the day when it was owned by, like...
I was on there just, you know, typing just crap. Just like, if you think Cutman's the best or
the
worst, then you deserve to die.
There's a lot of people typing crap on there, but yeah.
Yeah, ahead. Well... I've given up on typing. No, I haven't completely. It's my career now. I think I've been given an unreasonable sample, because, I mean, I was following like Nintendo Official Magazine, you know, every issue, just like, oh my god, the DS is coming. It's going to blow your balls out the back of your ass. Let's go. And they would have said that. It was a very crass magazine. I slightly turned it down, if anything.
It does sound very British.
Yeah, and it was just so exciting when it came out, because it just... Well, I said it already, really. I'm just ranting about the thing. But, you know, I'm going on forums. I think I was on, like, NeoGAF, that crappy forum at the time, and everyone's just dissecting everything to an inch of its life and going pouring over any minuscule amount of footage or screenshots that we got. Just this two-screen thing that's completely new. There's nothing. Well, there has been at least one thing like it before, but nothing quite so mass appeal, you know? And the touchscreen being brought in that completely... added this whole new dimension to anything that you could play. Wonderful. Just desperately exciting. I don't know if that's a reasonable sample, but I mean, as we'll get into, I'm sure, it was the fact that it was kind of not... that the touchscreen is such an immediate, obvious input compared to buttons and D-pad, that that's why it really kind of picked up and you got this whole kind of casual market for as well. I'm not sure if at launch... that was really clear that it was ever going to go in that direction until we got things like Brain Training. Or, I mean, I read books on that thing. You can get, like, friggin' Artemis Fowl on there, like all of the Artemis Fowl books. Like, yeah. Books with unlockables. They made books good. Like, it was insane.
I think, I actually was sent by Nintendo a collection of classic books. Like, I was the guide for the Nintendo DS for About.com at the time, and I got sent a whole bunch of weird stuff. But yeah, one of it was just like a collection of classic books. And it's like, it's actually not a terrible idea. This was before you could download this kind of
thing. Yeah, public domain stuff. That was really cool. I had the 101 classic book collection. I had that as well.
Nintendo sent me a bag of groceries so that I could write an article about their recipe book application. I can't remember what it was called, but it was not Cooking Mama, like an actual, here's a cookbook. Yeah,
I'll decide what to cook.
I can't even remember what it was, but we made tarragon chicken, and it was really good. And that's still like in our occasional rotation of things to make. So, who can say if it was?
Nintendo back then was sending like I worked.
I would occasionally,
and I got some really cool stuff from them.
You know, the way PR works is they find the people who cover their stuff, and they kind of check out their social media feeds and blogs, and occasionally I would blog about cooking or, food. Uh-huh. So they were like, oh, well, here's a person mm-hmm. who likes Nintendo and likes DS and also sometimes writes about cooking, so let's send him $100 worth of groceries and he can eat. And I guess you could consider that a kickback or a payoff, but... Sure. Okay. Yeah. That's the corruption inherent in the system. I had to make my own chicken meal. So yes, that's it. That's right there.
Hey, on the last podcast, you said that you were getting enough for grocery money. Now they're telling me they're sending you groceries.
They sent me groceries once. I can't live on a single bag of that chicken. At this point, would be pretty foul and not in the funny, clever, punny way. Yeah.
Not in the funny way. We'll never mind.
No,
that.
Slimy, bad.
Ugh. I don't want
to. More than damp.
I really think that
if
the
PR sent me groceries, I'd check out the poison personally.
Puddle of protein.
The double screen idea. I think that was one idea that I don't think people realized right away until you saw someone do something like that. Where just turn it sideways and it's like a book.
Yeah.
Because there were quite a few games that operated that way. Including Brain Trading, and also I think some adventure games. I was watching
Hotel Dust.
Yeah, Ninja Gaiden.
I was watching SGF play Hotel Dust the other day, and I was like, "Yeah, it's sideways."
What a great game!
And I do think, it's one more reason why even though the PSP had a lot more marketing attention and a lot more sort of general, initial hype. I'm not saying I wanted a PSP, but I'm just saying there was a lot more attention paid to the PSP. Sony's going hard. Sony's going handheld now. Sony's going to kick Nintendo where it hurts. But it's like, would you ever try to read a book on a PSP? I don't think so. I don't think you'd want to do that. But like a DS sideways where you have little pages, like that does kind of make sense. I mean, it's not a big screen, but still. And it's kind of sad that, the way the 3DS worked was that sort of like, that wouldn't work because the 3DS, you're supposed to have your eyes, on the top. Like that's, so it's like, It was a cool form factor of the double screen to go sideways, and then all of a sudden when they made the sequel, it's like, oh well, you know what? Don't do that anymore. Let's go back to this way. And it's kind of restrictive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Missed
out.
You know. Talking about all these like weird casual cases, I know this was the first system since the 2600 that my mother actually really got into, because there was a casual game collection, and I think Shanghai was on there, which she's obsessed with. And I remember she played that thing so much that on a DS Lite that she had me eventually go and buy her a new battery for it from Nintendo for Christmas because she wore the one out on that one so badly it could not hold a charge.
I didn't know it was possible to do that. I mean, I think I left my DS Lite on sleep for like a year and a half, and I turned it back on, and it was just like, "Yeah, let's keep playing Bomberman. What's the big deal? What are you being?"
Yeah, I don't know.
My mom loved it because she's got this sort of mischievous kind of competitive streak. So Brain Age, I'm like, "Hey, check this out!" And she's just like, "I'm going to destroy you all and have the smallest Brain Age of them all." Yeah, and it's a lot of fun. Like, I think Sudoku was on there. I think that, and she lost Puzzle Bobble. She was all over it. And I've never known her before or since to really even want to play any video games ever for any length of time for any reason. So there was definitely something there. I think it helped that it did have that look that wasn't just like, hey, kid's toy. Mm-hmm. It actually kind of did look nice. And the stylus is just a more refined input than a Kempston joystick or a pro controller or whatever.
Yeah, Nintendo, you really have to give it up for their batteries that they used to use. You know, my DSi XL had been in storage for years, and I recently picked it up to play through the Castlevania games again so that I could map them for the Dominus collection at limitedrungames.com. Available no longer. Sorry you missed it out by the time this episode's out, I'm afraid. Yeah, it's very sad. But the maps are in there, and they're really good because I made them. And, you know, it was fine. It had not lost any of its capacity whatsoever, and it's wow. currently downstairs asleep so that I can dive into Order of Ecclesia. So, good job, Nintendo. Nadia, let me ask you, since everyone's kind of done the round-robin thing and talked about their initial perceptions of the DS and where they were when that happened, you were like me, a little fledgling baby in games journalism at that point. So, what was your take on the thing? And did you have to be convinced at some point, or were you initially on Team DS?
Well, I mentioned that when we saw it at that presentation, I was like, oh god, that's ugly. But also at the same time, I was like, well, Nintendo, the GameCube tried to be powerful, and it just tried to be a typical system, and it just didn't really suit Nintendo. So I thought to myself, whatever crazy shit Nintendo has planned for this thing, I'm sure it'll work out. And if it doesn't, it's got the Game Boy compatibility, so, you know, Bob's your uncle either way. But I was very poor when it came out, so for a long time I had to ignore it. By the time I did play it, I have a very good friend who actually bought myself and my husband, like, one DS Fat each, and I got the red one, and my husband got the black one. And I think the red one came with Mario Kart, which was a great Mario Kart game. I still love it. Still one of my favorites. So I was sold quite easily on the DS when I finally got it. And I did actually notice at the time, because I was still reading like game magazines, how, oh my god, everything looks so weird and boring except for these DS games. Like, I think it was Perfect Blue. What was it called? I can't remember what the game's name was, but...
Not Lost Perfect Blue.
Lost in Blue.
Lost in Blue. Lost in Blue. There you go.
I don't think Perfect Blue would have been appropriate for the target audience for DS.
Is Perfect Blue a porn or something? I don't know.
It's not a porn, but it's a very harrowing and somewhat, like, not quite explicit, but very difficult to watch psychological thriller by Satoshi Kon.
It's sexy.
I know we got Platoon on the sexy. NES.
I mean, there's definitely sex stuff that happens, but none of it's good.
There are applications of the stylus, but we don't want to double them, really. Yeah,
so I was pretty much Team DS. And yes, I was a fledgling games journalist. I had just started at 1UP.com. I almost called it US Gamer, my god. And I spent a lot of time covering the DS. As I mentioned, I became the guide, quote-unquote, to the Nintendo DS at about.com when it existed, back when it was owned by Ask Jeeves, I think. And I became the guide for the 3DS as well. I was on the job for a while. And, yeah, so I was just really impressed, not only by the fact that the DS had these games that were fantastic, but also that they had these very stylus-driven adventure games. Just basically, they made really good use of the stylus a lot of the time. Like, I remember playing the first Picross game I ever played was Picross 3D, which was a great game. I think I was sent that for review, and I was like, wow, Picross rules. And then I was sent the DSi, and I had never really gotten the DS Lite. I'd always stuck to my Fat, but when I got my DSi, like, I was like, oh, shit, this is new now. And that I liked very much because you had some weird-ass games you could download that never appeared anywhere else. Like, I played the Shantae sequel. I was like, oh, this is really, really good. I like this.
That has appeared other places.
That has, yes. But
I get what you're saying.
There was a Dragon Quest tactical game, for example, and it's not the Dragon Quest tactical game on the phone, which I think is shut down now. But it was, it was just had all these strange independent games that it was such a unique little system. I just liked the DS. It was very versatile. I liked the fact it had adventure games. I loved Hotel Dusk, as I mentioned earlier. It was... Oh, and I should mention that was around the time that I was working with Anthony John Agnello on 61 frames per second. That was our one, like, a very early blog that started. I think Bob Mackey wrote for it as well. Yeah, he did. And that was me just writing a whole bunch about DS games, especially Final Fantasy IV DS, which was a really, really strange but interesting adaptation of the original game. I say to people that to this day, do not play that as your first Final Fantasy IV, as much as Square seems to want you to.
Yeah, that was definitely not the casual audience of the DS style Dragon or sorry Final Fantasy approach.
No, I loved it, but I'm a sicko. I'm like, oh, okay, so you completely upended the fight with the antlion. Good for you.
Oh, you liked the easy type? Well, try this one. See what you think of this one.
Here's the easy type.
Good times.
Okay, but okay, I'm learning now. Don't play that version first. Gotcha. I won't. I'll play the PSP version. How's that?
I love the PSP version.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You touched something very important there, Jeremy. It's like, no, a lot of those, you know, like the Final Fantasies, the Dragon Quest, are certainly not necessarily a casual audience. But because the DS blew up, and because the DS drew so many eyeballs back to Nintendo hardware, and a Nintendo portable hardware, which was, you know, not as expensive to develop for as, you know, the PlayStations and so forth, you had this sort of thing where it's like, okay, yeah, Nintendogs and Brain Training are selling each. Well, this system's very popular. Let's put more games on it. And you saw more games coming to DS, and you saw more games localized for that DS games were being localized abroad. And so I believe you had, like, a whole bunch of Final Fantasies come out on DS that never came out in English before. You had Dragon Quest come out on DS that never came out.
Retronauts got its start so that we could talk about Final Fantasy III for DS. That is the origin story of this entire podcast.
That's
almost
20
years later. Yep.
Yes. So I think that is important. You know, when a system like that hits it big, and it has, you know, a low barrier to entry as far as, you know, development costs go, I really do think it was overall a net positive for all sorts of games, not just, you know. Not just the, touch the colorful buttons and win some candy kind of stuff. Like, you know, there were tons of intense, like, I remember, you know, I think someone already said Shiren the Wanderer before, but yeah, Shiren the Wanderer 5, which is now available as, I want to say, like, the Dice of Fate or the...
The Tower of Fate and the Dice of Fortune? The Tower
yes,
of Fortune
you.
And the Dice of Fate, yeah. Something like that. I worked on the limited run release of that. I reviewed the game. I still can't remember the the exact way it should be parsed. Subtitle.
It's now available on lots of platforms, including Switch. But for when it launched, it was just called Shiren 5, and it was only in Japanese. But that was like, you know, at that point, I had heard a lot about Shiren the Wanderer, and I was like, oh, well, this new game's out. Let's give this a try. And I ended up being totally hooked on it because it was a really good game to play. Like, you know, I was commuting to work every day on a train. Like, oh, perfect. Put Shiren the Wanderer in there. Give it a go.
Finally, Sokoban on a portable system.
And it's just like, you know, did I die a lot? Sure. But if I managed to survive long enough on my train ride, the DS was sturdy enough that I could just close it and put it in my bag and go to work, and then I'd finish my game on the way home and then die on the way home, you know?
Something that Nadia mentioned, it just sort of prompts the thought that it was so diverse, the library, and it allowed for so many different means of input, like... Friggin' Age of Empires, you know, is on the DS, right there alongside of 2D Mario and Sonic, and I think one of the first sort of, and then it was definitely the first sort of visual novel I played was the first Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney, because of the whole, I guess, the novelty appeal of what there's a game where you, like, an action anime game where you play as a lawyer and you've got to get them off. That's amazing. I've got to try
brilliant.
This. And then, holy shit, it is brilliant. It's way more than just novelty. And then from there, I get into things like, you know, all the rest of sequels to that game, which I played. And that sort of made me think, well, if this is good, maybe I should check out other genres that I normally wouldn't touch with a barge pole, except with the stylus. It's also comfortable and you can play it in bed and, I mean, Professor Layton, for Christ's sake.
Yeah,
all those, like, all of those, and I would never have thought to play those before the DS.
Want to hear something very irritating about Professor
yes,
Layton?
Yes, always.
Okay,
I do.
So your version of Professor Layton, you probably had metric measurements, right? For the puzzles.
I honestly don't remember, but I think we had different names for all the games.
Oh, you did.
I honestly don't remember.
Canada uses the metric system, but a lot of the time we get U.S. localizations. Except once in a very rare while, we get a weird, like, Canadian localization because Quebec screwed things up somehow. And, for years, I had to play these stupid Layton games using with puzzles with the Imperial system, which, if you live in Canada, you use a mix of both. It's really strange. Like, we're really weird people. But I cannot solve these puzzles with Imperial measurements. What is an ounce? Someone please tell me. I cannot visualize an ounce. It does not work.
It's a 16th of a pound, obviously. Come on.
Nadia, you got high. How do you not know what an ounce is?
I vape, my dear. And that's measured in grams. Yeah, and it wasn't until the very last game that we finally got, like, a Canadian localization that used, like, the U.S. title, for example, but metric puzzles. And then the series died, the end.
Wait, did they put a maple leaf on
its hat? That's what killed it.
I wish they did. They have, you know, the Golden Arches has a maple leaf on it here.
I've been to Canada. I know. The little tweak they put on all the designs, the Pizza Hut.
Yeah.
Has a leaf.
I would have liked a maple leaf on his hat. That would have been great.
Diamond, I want... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Stuart.
I didn't say anything. I was just sitting here in rapt silence.
Kevin.
I was going to say, I really liked the Chrono Trigger port on the DS. You're talking about all these RPGs.
That was good.
And, like, they were doing a great job bringing a lot of these, you know, big ones out in sort of a... Well, it was then a playable format again and, like, adding a bunch of stuff. And the other really hardcore game that I remember putting a lot of time into was, for whatever reason, Midway reissued Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 on the DS.
Oh, hell. Yeah.
And it was shockingly, like, an excellent port to the point where I remember going to, like, some local events when Street Fighter 4 came out with a friend of mine. We were just, like, sitting off to the side playing money matches in Mortal Kombat on the DS. People kept coming up and they're like, what are you doing? What are you playing? I'm like, oh, it's Mortal Kombat. Is it any good? Yeah. Is this like a real match? Yeah, we're playing for like $20.
Yeah, it even had puzzle combat in there.
And it had puzzle combat, which was awful.
Street Fighter,
but it was there.
So, Diamond, I want to go back to something you were talking about the, you know, the way the DS blew up. And how that had such an impact on just the library and the kind of games that you saw. When we talked about the Dreamcast, we kind of pegged it as the end of an era and a transition into a new era. I feel the DS...
Doomed Sega.
Yes, doomed Sega, that's right. The DS has that same... I can't think of anything. That same kind of appeal, that same kind of... Day ne sais quoi. I don't think that's a real thing. I thought you were doing the DS thing. Say isn't spelled with an S either. Come on, Stuart.
What do I look like? A French? You think this letter on my head stands for France?
Okay. It could. I don't know. It looks like a baguette to me. So, as I was going to say, the DS also represents, I think, the end of an era, which is it's really the final system, I guess but that was kind of a different thing. The final system where development was really, really cheap. It was easy and affordable to put together a game, and you didn't have to sell it for a lot of money to make back your costs. And that allowed, you know, and it had a huge footprint. So just by virtue of so many people owning a DS, you could put something out there. And at least until, you know, piracy kind of killed it off, you could put something out there and it would probably do okay. Even if it was really bizarre and hard to explain the appeal of, that sort of peak DS era between like 2006 and 2009... It was so fertile for just the weirdest, most inventive games. You got lots of bread and butter titles, you know, the kind of expected games that you would say, oh yeah, of course we're getting this. But then there were also just there was this huge library of games that you would look at it and say, I don't know what this is, but it's very intriguing. And that made, you know, for me, someone in the press covering games, that made writing a lot of fun because there was an unpredictability to it. And there was a good chance that I would pick up something, I would be assigned something, and going into it, not know what to expect, and come out of it with an appreciation for a new genre, or having said, wow, this is a really fun new take on old ideas, or this is just an idea I've never seen before. And I feel like we haven't seen that again. I feel like that was sort of the end of that phase of gaming because things became more expensive to create. And, you know, you do have indie game development and there are indies out there putting out original ideas, but the majority of indie games are like, hey, I really loved Castlevania growing up. Now I'm going to make, you know, a Metroidvania game. Or I really loved Torneko when I was growing up, so now I'm going to make a roguelike. And so it becomes much more iterative. But the DS, it was just this, almost like this infinite landscape of discovery. Unlike Xbox 360, which was infinite undiscovery. It's the opposite of the DS. It was a thrill to cover that platform because I loved the novelty of it. I loved being surprised. Importing stuff was always just, you know, we would spend like $150 a month just getting stuff for 1UP from National Console Support. So like 5 or 6 games would come in and sometimes they'd be total crap. Sometimes they'd be promising but made very badly, but sometimes they'd be like, oh, this is really neat, this is interesting. Like I think it was Devilish, game. I can't remember if that was localized, but that was one of those but we picked it up, you know, at its initial import because I was like, I don't know what this is, but it's got a kind of a cool cover, so it's, you know, $35. It's Ziff Davis. We've got money to throw everywhere. We're flush with cash. Let's do it. And it turned out to be kind of cool. There was like a roguelike based on the Windaria anime, like from the 1980s. They just said, hey, it's been 20 years. Let's make a roguelike about this old forgotten anime. Okay, sure. Why not? Wasn't that great, but. It was out there. It was a lot of fun. I do miss that time. I also miss that time in my life where I, you know, could just tinker around and experiment with things instead of having my life very rigidly booked to existing commitments. But personally a good time for me, and also a really good, fun, inventive time for the medium.
It really was.
I can't believe they made
a fun time right for games. Sorry, Kevin.
I was going to say, I can't believe they made a Pac-Man game where the whole premise was that you had to draw a Pac-Man.
And
like, depending on how you did it is how like effective he would be at.
You can make some really sad-looking Pac-Man.
It was shockingly good. It was amazing. I remember liking that. Yeah.
Like, I can't believe that game exists, and I can't believe like it worked so well.
I'm gonna get all sort of video world now, but that was a good system for Pac-Man, the DS. You had that. You had Pac and Roll, which was pretty sweet, I have to say. Oh, I
forgot about Pac and Roll.
And you had the Pac-Man World 3 port, which was serviceable.
The best you can say about Pac-Man World 3, honestly.
Patton Oswalt sounding Pac-Man. That's pretty funny, I thought.
But yeah, like I remember there was the Geometry Wars port on there that used the touchscreen to sort of fill in for the second analog stick, and it worked amazingly. Like, I know they put it on the Wii as well, and it was not quite as nice as the DS version.
Yeah. I feel like the fact that it was this sort of unusual at the time, innovative kind of input, it almost kind of like spurred on even the shovelware developers to be like, well, I got to use this in some way, because, like, I'm going to be the guy who brings it up. They put, like, Call of Duty Modern Warfare on that thing, and it wasn't garbage. It was actually kind of fun, strafing with the D-pad, aiming and firing with the L button. It actually kind of worked, you know? And I feel like we got a lot. I mean, I've said it earlier, and I got to repeat it, but when I just sit back and think about how many sort of games I played on this thing, and it was a lot, and so many of them were brilliant, and I want to play them now. It compared to almost anything before or since. I love the Switch, but it's mostly ports of things I already love, you know? The DS is just this absolute bounty of just total originals, and even when they did bring them out on other stuff, like The World Ends With You, it's nowhere near as good on any other system as it is on the DS. And, I miss it. I kind of want to go back, you know?
It did take a while for the DS library to sort of come into its own. I feel like people's skepticism about the system in the early days is understandable because, one, Nintendo was not in a good place. Mm-hmm. Two, it immediately evoked memories of the Virtual Boy, where they kind of hedged the bets. It was like, hey, we're doing this thing in addition to Game Boy. Oh, it's not good. It's a failure. DS was the same way. They were like, here's our third pillar. We're going to continue to have Game Boy, but also you can get this other thing. Please, please buy our stuff.
They lied.
But then those early games, a lot of them, you know, you were paying $30 for kind of what in, you know, a couple of years later would just be like a mini game inclusion with another game. Honestly, by that point, you already had the, you know, the Super Mario Advance games that came with like every Mario game on Game Boy Advance came with a port of Mario Brothers that had multiplayer with networking. And it kind of felt like they were, with those early games, giving you like the bonus Mario Brothers game and then charging you full price for it. So things like Yoshi's Touch and Go, you know, the Pikachu racing game that was controlled entirely with a stylus. There were a bunch of those early games where it just felt like this is not fully baked. Is this really all this system is going to be capable of? Because I can't see myself paying money for an experience like this. It is not the Atari 2600 era anymore, and games need to have more substance, or at least more breadth. And those early games were not delivering on that. So
yeah,
you can certainly understand why people kind of gave it the stink eye.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because like Mario 64, one of the launch, I want to say it was a launch game. It must have been a launch game.
Yeah, it was.
And,
yes.
Even that kind of separates off its touchscreen stuff with the main game. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got these the mini games, one of which is Sortusplode, which, as we all know, is the greatest game ever made. But it's still totally separate from that. It's like, look, you've bought this thing, and yes, it's got a normal, nice normal game on it, but you can also play blackjack with Luigi. You know, that's, you know, this is the thing we can do. And it doesn't do anything to make you think this is not a gimmick. This is not integrated with the sort of whole experience. It did take a while to really come around to that. I've been trying to think what the first real truly integrated thing was, but in a way they never really got there, in a sense.
I think that the first game I heard getting like praise for implementing that form of gameplay was the Kirby Canvas Curse, I think it was called.
That was a great game.
I remember that being like people saying, hey, I understand this now, this is actually a game that the touchscreen, that the, where the touchscreen is needed.
I feel like that came after Nintendogs, which was really kind
That's
of the
true.
Breakout for the system into the sort of mass audience that Nintendo was targeting with the system. Like when they created the DS, they had that really broad casual audience of people who just want to play with little pretend animals in mind, but it took a while to communicate that. And then when Nintendogs finally came along, and I believe it came in tow with the DS Lite, or maybe it came slightly before, that and Animal Crossing were kind of the breakouts, where all of a sudden DS was like, oh yeah, it's not necessarily going to be this hardcore gaming platform, but you know, your grandparents are going to love it because they can pretend to throw a frisbee or pet a little chihuahua.
It was sort of
all things to all gamers, I guess, in that respect. I mean, you say it's not for the hardcore gaming system, but I mean, it kind of was if you wanted to play those games. I mean, we had so many JRPGs and dungeon crawlers. I mean, Etrian Odyssey, you know?
Yeah, but all of those came later, I would say. You had the sort of casual breakout first with Animal Crossing, Nintendogs, Brain Age, a little bit of the more traditional games with Mario Kart, which came around the same time.
I was going to say, when Mario Kart comes out, that's usually the system seller, the big
one. And the first handheld that was online, right? You could visit each other's towns in Wild World, and you could play each other at Mario Kart and stuff.
Oh,
that is true.
Yeah, that actually came into play when... this is a story I've told on Blood Guide, so I really apologize if I'm repeating myself here, but yeah... Animal Crossing was another game that really got me into the DS, and it had like this real kind of primitive but interesting version of online. And of course, you have those quests that you start the game with. Tom Nook is like, do this, do my job for me. And one of the last things he tells you to do is write a message on the board for your town. So I wrote, Tom Nook blows goats, I have proof. And nice. Apparently, your messages can end up in other people's towns somehow, because on LiveJournal, someone said, who wrote this and why is it in my town? And it was Tom Nick Blows Goats, I have proof. And I'm like, oh, that was me. I didn't know that could happen. So, yeah, it was
And you are why they have to have the little message that says online experience or rating may change online with online experience.
No, I think the reason that happened is because, and this is another story I actually just had on Blood God yesterday. So again, I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but I wasn't there for this. But there was that incident where they previewed the 3DS at some event, sorry, the DS at some event with PictoChat, and there was Miyamoto and Reggie. Some game journalist drew a giant dong. Some other game journalist accidentally pressed the button that sent the dong directly to Miyamoto, who apparently just shook his head. And I'm like, God damn, can you imagine getting... That is the worst burn you could possibly receive. That is like getting disapproval from God and every teacher and every parent you've ever had. And apparently Reggie was really pissed off, and this person got kicked out. But I just love the idea of Miyamoto seeing a giant dong. I'm sorry, Miyamoto, I respect the hell out of you, but what do you expect?
Yeah, come on. There was two things you could do with PictoChat, and it was draw dongs and draw the bicycle sequence from California Games in shadow.
It's reminded me of that game Drawn to Life. Does anyone remember that
one? Oh, yes, where I remember you... that.
Because I got that game, and I mean, obviously, look, my character was obviously an enormous erection. Like, I mean, what? Of course it was. Like, what else was it going to be? And then the next thing you do is you design its weapon. So I drew another dick, and then the weapon fires like white goo, and I'm like, they fucking knew. And then of course I got bored with the game and I traded it in, and then I remembered that I'd forgotten to delete any of the data. So I hope some little kid didn't buy that and go, what the hell is going on here?
Well,
it was a learning experience.
I see we've reached the dick section of the podcast.
So we've talked a lot about the DS in a sort of digressive sort of conversation. But yes.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about what the system represented in terms of Nintendo's own legacy, both, you know, what it built on and what it built toward. Because, you know, even at the time, despite the skepticism about the DS in the media, I think people were pretty keen to pick up on various notes and references that it contained, the sort of threads of Nintendo history that it represented. And, you know, I think people who were sort of willing to give it more of a chance than others were the ones who looked and said, oh, wait, a handheld with two screens, they've done this before. And, you know, to just kind of look at the odd little choices they made with it and kind of come to a better understanding of what Nintendo was trying to do. I mean, even the casual audience thing that they were shooting toward, that wasn't something Nintendo had really specifically targeted, at least in its public messaging. I remember going to, this was back when Nintendo would host media events up at its headquarters. They did that like three or four times during this era. And as the guy who actually gave a shit about Nintendo at 1UP, they would send me up to that. And, you know, I remember when Reggie Bizeme gave his first talk about the Blue Ocean strategy, which I think happened at the event where they let us play Mario Kart DS early and then take a cartridge home and get to lord it over all of our friends. That was actually something pretty new for them in terms of a deliberate strategy, but it's something that they had already, like, they'd always been kind of pushing toward that casual market. They were a toy company first and foremost, but if you look back at the Nintendo, the NES era, you look at the games that Nintendo chose to license from other companies and publish themselves, and you have the ones that people remember, like, you know, Dragon Warrior, where they were saying, well, this was big in Japan. Now, 3 years later, this RPG that was kind of ahead of its time in 1986 will surely go over well with Americans, not so successfully. But at the same time, they also localized and published things like dance aerobics and oh crap, what's that like Pictionary style game? Just totally
anticipation.
Yes. You know, so they were taking these games, like Dance Aerobics was a Bandai game in Japan, and it was for the Power Pad. And it basically, like, that game was really interesting because it's kind of like the first dance pad rhythm game. It has a music playing mode. So, you know, that was definitely not a game that was catering toward the power users of the NES who wanted another Mario game or who were like, yeah, I can't wait for Ninja Gaiden 2 to kill me as badly as Ninja Gaiden did. It was, you know, the cover art has for Dance Aerobics is like nine photographs of people, and it's like a broad spectrum of ages, genders, races. It's saying like, hey, this is a game for everyone. This is, you know, you've got an NES in your living room. You might as well get something useful out of it for everyone. And that was always a core tenet of Nintendo's marketing strategy in a way that I can't really think of anything that Sega did that was comparable. I can't think of anything that, you know, latter-day Atari did or that Sony did even really in the 90s with PlayStation. Like, I can't think of games that were targeted, you know, game experiences, interfaces that were targeted toward the non-core gaming audience. And DS was really, I personally feel, where Nintendo finally said, you know what, this is one of our primary strengths. It is the fact that we can appeal to an audience that is normally unserved, or at least underserved by the rest of the games industry, we can get them. And they sort of created the casual games market right there, but just by saying, like, here's a game system that you can immediately intuit the interface for because it's a touchscreen, that's obvious, and you get to pet doggies. Like, what's not to like, everyone?
Yeah, Jeremy, you just said something very important, the fact that Nintendo was publishing the software themselves, because it just came to mind, I just looked it up to double-check, and it's true. Oandan, one of the great rhythm games and one of the great DS games. That's a Nintendo published game in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a game where it's like, obviously not the first rhythm game, but a really great rhythm game and one that makes great use of the touchscreen. It's like, okay, look, we're gonna play some music, we're gonna show you some funny animations. All you gotta do is follow the animations and poke some buttons and drag your screen, and like, it was incredibly easy to play. You know, exhibit A, me. I'm not good at rhythm games. I feel like I have a genetic, you know, problem with rhythm. I don't know if I understand how rhythm
works.
My
husband.
But I could follow Oandan. I could drag my thing. I could drag my stylus around the screen. I could touch the beats, and it all worked beautifully. And I was so in love with that game. I wish I still had my copy, but I sent it to someone else. You know, I hope they're enjoying it. But it is just. That's a great example of, you know, Nintendo takes something. It's like, oh yeah, we'll take a chance on that. And that was also an early one. That was July 2005. So that's pre-Light, you know, the original Oandan. And that was
My favorite band from the 90s.
And they did a really big localization job. Like, that was a complete overhaul. Yeah. And I love
Was Elite Beat Agents the first video game to use a licensed pop song to elicit genuine emotions from players? I can't think of
a previous
that,
Jeremy.
Example.
That reminds
I'm sorry,
me.
But
if
you
I,
have to.
I was
Christmas is coming soon, and it's time to be sad.
Oh, when I hear that song, that's what I think of immediately. But there's also a scene you can get if you're doing badly, and you have this really like sad song going on. And if you do badly, there's a point where she can find a picture of her dad, like in a thong, like posing for the camera with big muscles, and she's like, "Daddy." And then you get a big X because you screwed up. I love
wow,
that
so
much.
You got screwed up.
Oh god!
But no, I can't think of another example of a publisher taking, you know, paying for the rights to license a very successful popular song, and then saying, "Let's use this to make the people playing this game cry." so that it will be extra challenging because they'll have to hit all those beats and follow the on-screen guidelines with tears in their eyes.
The only example I can think of is, I'm afraid it is a Spectrum game, but the official video game of the score to Blade Runner by Vangelis. And when you play it, you hear like the music and you just start weeping because you've bought this with your own money and that money's gone and it's never coming back. Never coming back.
Different kind of emotional reaction, but sure.
Yeah.
What a game that was.
But something you mentioned about the barrier to entry being removed by making it the touchscreen, obviously. And everyone, I mean, you know, if you're doing Sudoku or you're doing Picross or you're doing a crossword, because there was freaking loads of crossword apps on that thing. You're doing the same thing. You're scrolling on paper, and it's the only difference is here you're scrolling on a touchscreen, and anyone can understand that, no matter what. And taking away the obstacle of the D-pad of the buttons, which, I mean, I don't want to, you know, tar anyone with the same brush here, but, like, for my parents in particular, that's completely beyond them for some reason. I don't know why. They can't grok that at all, but they can pick up the stylus and they can go, yeah, I get this, I understand this, I can write a number three, it's just you're removing a lot, and that's sort of what they extended into the Wii as well, because anyone can understand pointing a TV remote at the screen, and if you move your hand the thing moves, there's no disconnect, you know. Well, I mean, there's a bit of lag, but there is no disconnect, and it's understandable. And I, you know, they really must have brought that forward from the whole, okay, all the grannies and granddads love the DS. Some of them have little, like, DSs in little knitted DS pouches next to their bedside table, next to their TV.
DS cozy.
Yeah. I've seen them. They're real. It's great. I want one. But then extending that forward into what they made afterwards, it's just accessibility. It's just another form of accessibility. And they really nailed it here in a way that they absolutely didn't with the Game Boy Advance whatsoever. it was wonderful. And I'm sure there were lots of people who came on board through that and when started playing Bangalore Spirits, you know. I'm sure they exist.
Yeah, Nintendo, the two-screen setup had been with them for 20 years by that point, because back in 1984, they created the game Punch-Out, which looked really cool, and also had a second screen over top of the main screen, not in the way that Dragon's Lair did, where you could add a second monitor and people could crowd around to watch you die horribly as Dirk the Daring, but rather they just needed to use up a bunch of extra monitors they had in their pipeline. And so they integrated that second monitor into the cabinet to use for scoring and things like that. And then that carried into the PlayChoice 10 system, where you had like the game on one screen and then the PlayChoice interface and information, like a map for Metroid. If you wanted to be weird and play Metroid on PlayChoice 10, that was up there. That was kind of, you know, the prelude to the Nintendo DS right there, was putting a map in PlayChoice 10 Metroid for people to reference. But even before that, you had their dual screen Game & Watch systems like Donkey Kong, where, you know, the Game & Watch was necessarily limited and it had a pretty small screen with only X number of elements that were available on the screen because it was all preset and silk screened. So to give you the full scope of a Donkey Kong experience, they added a second screen. So Mario kind of goes up a couple of ramps and then he makes a transition to another screen and goes up more ramps to take on Donkey Kong. And so like the form factor of DS predates the DS by about 22 years, I think.
Yeah.
Something in that neighborhood. And, you know, that's just Nintendo continuing to bring back ideas and build on them. At the same time, some of the ideas that showed up in DS, I don't think Nintendo had done before, like the touch screen, but that was something that Game.com by Tiger, I want to say, incorporated. The day planner stuff you had on Game.com, and you also had on the Neo Geo Pocket Color, where there was like a built-in calendar and, you know, NGPC had a horoscope app and things like that, like this kind of casual stuff. And, you know, no one bought that system, sadly. So no one knew about that stuff. But Nintendo sort of resurfaced it and said, let's give people this sort of you know, user interface.
There were whispers of it. I mean, there was, with the Game Boy, there was that whole Workboy project that they did sort of put a time into but never released, I guess. And then things like the Game Boy printer and the Game Boy camera, in a way, are sort of leaning in that direction, something anyone can understand. And, you know, everyone wants to take photos of their friends and then mutate them into disgusting freaks, don't they? And some of us require.
I mean, I just make friends with mutant freaks to begin with.
Hello.
It saves the trouble.
Hello, it's your friend Jeremy. How are you?
They're really into mini printers and printing out stickers, and basically the Game Boy's camera was decades ahead of its time, as you well know, Parrish.
Yeah, where's the?
I do well know.
Where's the DS printer? A missed opportunity.
Yeah,
I mean, I know it didn't have a camera, but you know,
the DSi have a camera for, didn't it?
It did. Yes.
The WarioWare snaps.
That's right.
When you
it was really bad.
Yeah, when you open up my DSi, it still has a photograph that I took in like 2009, 2010, just a random snapshot in my office at 1UP. There's like a little Starship Enterprise model, and you can't make out anything else because the camera quality is so bad.
So smeary.
So I still got this this Enterprise model that no longer exists. It got broken sometime in the past, and it's very sad.
It's
still there. It's like a memory of like the 2 months that I was in this little office.
So, talking of things that it carried forward, I might be way off the mark here, but the DS having the microphone that mostly was used for blowing into, that's from the Famicom controller, right? That's something that they used to have.
Yeah, controller too.
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord. I mean, I am probably the only person on Earth who loves Spirit Tracks.
One
of my favorite Zelda.
You have my sword.
Yes, it's so good. I love Trains. Trains and Zelda, holy shit, why the hell not? Mm-hmm. Except for that last boss, where you had to blow into the microphone. I was like, fuck this, I'm not beating this game. Where's the ending on YouTube?
There's a Frogger game called My Frogger Toy Trials, which I've now mentioned two podcasts in a row for some reason, where one of the challenges is that you have to do one of those raft races. Like, you know, you make a little raft, put it on the river, and then your frog floats down the river. And the way you do it is you blow into the mic, and the only way to win is to blow into the mic for an uninterrupted 1 minute and 30 seconds. And I think children died playing that game, if anyone had bought it, which they didn't, thank God.
There's no way to look cool like blowing into the microphone.
It really
isn't.
If you're on a bus and it's like blow into the microphone, hell no.
Yeah, you can do almost all of Phoenix Wright. You can just blow into the microphone for the objection.
You
and hold it.
Objection.
And yeah, but then at the end of the game, right at the end of the credits, you do it one final time, and you can't press the button. You have to do it properly. And I was on a train. And I was like, oh shit! I guess I'm not finishing this now.
Yeah. It's really funny that Nintendo gave us the system that you have to look like an absolute idiot to be able to play some of the games on, at the same time that they put out the Game Boy Micro and were like, this is the cool, sexy, slim system that you can take to the bar and the ladies are gonna love you. It's very, very, like, very mixed messaging right there.
How on earth is that gonna... Never mind. Don't worry about it.
Wow,
just producing that thing in the bar,
NES,
and you're like, yeah.
Game Boy?
Hello, you're like, yeah, that's right. It's
Tiny
Mario vs. Donkey.
Ooh, is he playing Mega Man Zed on this very, very tiny screen? He must have amazing finger dexterity. I want to get to know this guy.
Donkey Kong.
That's all I can think of. It's just, you know, it's showing off. It's like, I may not be a surgeon, ladies, but my hands are still good.
There you are.
I can play Game Boy Micro.
I guess if you can blow into the mic for an uninterrupted 1 minute 30 seconds, then maybe there's something there you can build
You're
on.
You're superhuman.
Yeah. But when you mention My Frogger, it's just usually the end of the conversation for me.
Uh-oh. Diamond seems disturbed.
I
think they like the micro.
I'm thinking about... Well, yeah, I do. I wish I had gotten the micro at the time. And I'm just thinking back to that era of how... The micro came out, and it was like the 20th anniversary of Mario, and I was actually in Japan at that point, and like all the media and all the press and all the advertisements were all in on Game Boy Micro and Mario being 20, and I don't think they even talked about the DS at all that fall at all. It's like, no, here's Game Boy Micro. So I think they weren't even at that point. They weren't even sure if the DS was gonna hang in there, maybe. But I mostly think about how, you know, with all the DS features it had. And it's funny, you mentioned that, yes, some games were nothing but weird features, and you looked at it, you're like, what the hell is this? And some games got it right, and some games got it wrong. And yet, it was such a bizarre mix of, you know, if you get it right, it's going to work. If you don't get it right, it's going to look stupid. And some games, like, you would still enjoy them despite looking stupid. Like, I would say some of the Zelda games, like, yeah, I don't want to blow into the microphone right now, but I am having a lot of fun controlling Link with a stylus. But then, like, I think about, well, what happened? What happened after DS? Well, DS did pretty well, and we had all these games that were, you know, using the touchscreen, some of them innovatively, some of them just cheaply. And then a couple years into the DS's life, smartphones exploded. And all of a sudden, you had smartphone games that were all about touchscreens, and I don't think too many smartphone games made you speak in the microphone, but at least there was a sort of, an evolution there. Was like, oh, a cheap game that you use your touchscreen for. Well, now everyone has a touchscreen in their pockets, so we don't need to make a DS game anymore. Let's make a smartphone game. And it's funny how it all came together, and then all of a sudden it all just sort of left. And, you know, I mean, Nintendo did okay, but I feel like that really hurt Sony when Sony was like, oh, touchscreens are in. Oh, wait, touchscreens are in, and they're not even on consoles anymore. They're on phones. And so Sony's like, I guess we better make a handheld with a touchscreen. And boy, that didn't quite work out.
Oh, I love the Vita. God bless.
Two touchscreens. I'm sorry. They made a handheld with two touchscreens.
Oh, the butt.
To make
sure
you had to touch the screens constantly.
Yeah, that was really fun when the camera kept friggin' moving because that was bound to the back of the friggin' touchscreen. A piece of shit. Sorry.
We still need a Vita 2. It's entirely possible that... Yes, we do. They may have announced something along those lines at Tokyo Game Show. This is being recorded before Tokyo Game Show 2024. Diamond is shaking their head no.
I'm sorry. We're recording this in the wake of the PS5 Pro. They're not going to follow the PS5 Pro. Oh, by the way, we're also doing an expensive handheld, you know... They did an expensive handheld. It's called the PlayStation Portal, and it's for playing your PS5 games only at home on a tiny screen.
You know, Sony is...
We have the Steam Deck at home.
I was going to say, Sony is a company with a lot of hubris, so I could see it.
Oh.
There's interesting Sony and there's arrogant Sony. I like one better than the other.
As much as we talk up the DS, I have to say it was a fantastic generation in general for handheld, because the PSP also kicked lots of ass in a very different way, and I'm hoping we'll do an episode on that at some point, or have done one and I've missed it and I forgot and I was in it maybe.
I don't want to dump on Sony too much right now. I'm just saying,
I do.
It's funny how, you know, the PSP went from highly anticipated to, oh, well, it's not as popular as the DS, to, oh, geez, not even the DS is popular as the DS anymore. What are we going to do now? And then it repeated all over with the 3DS again. It's like, oh, 3DS is good. Oh, wait till you see this Vita. Oh, the Vita's going to rule. I was like, no, it didn't.
No. Really didn't. Thank you for your proprietary battery, Sony. That was great. That was really amazing to find a system and then to have to go all over Toronto to find the one store in some corner of some shack that had a battery that I could buy.
And thank you.
On the plus side, it'll eventually swell and then explode and burn down your storage unit. So that's cool. Yes.
Boy, good times, good times.
The dream.
Yeah, actually, you know, mentioning Vita reminds me of the Vita boat, which reminds me of being in Japan for events. And that was someplace the DS really shined. You know, the DS was extremely popular in Japan, as it was everywhere. But the proto-networking, proto-StreetPass features that some of the games there, or some of the games for DS integrated, Nintendo was really kind of, you know, feeling things out for a while, and some of their partners too, really added to the life of that system, you know, and the density of Japan and, you know, most of the population is clustered into a few major cities, made it really an effective and useful sort of game experience. And especially when Dragon Quest IX came out, that was very famous. I mean, one, like, that was the real sign of the DS's importance and significance, when this long-running series, kind of like one of the pillars of the Japanese games industry, like every release is an event, that came to the DS, where the previous version, the previous iteration had been on PlayStation 2. So that's actually a technical, like, undeniable technical step downward in you know, graphical fidelity and capabilities, but Enix and, well, Square Enix and, you know, their development partners integrated that proto Street Pass into the game.
Yeah.
And yeah, the pub, and allowed you to share maps and other things. And, you know, in addition to having like this cycle of weekly downloads where you could just add new stuff to the game officially, they had the social aspect. And, you know, the year that I took my copy of Dragon Quest IX to Tokyo and scored all the rare maps and then took them back to the office made me feel pretty good about myself. I was able to, you know, pass on the Kawasaki locker and other assorted things. But, you know, it was just fun to sort of loiter around. And someone mentioned recently on Blue Sky talking about the McDonald's Street Pass integration that they had, not Street Pass, the McDonald's Wi-Fi.
Yes.
When Mario Kart DS launched. When Mario DS launched, Mario Kart DS launched, McDonald's made a deal with Nintendo or vice versa to allow you to use little network kiosks in their restaurants for free online connectivity. So, you know, you could go, if you didn't have Wi-Fi at home, which was, it was still pretty new then, you could go to McDonald's and, you know, clearly you would buy food while you're there and play Mario Kart. And, you know, that continued on in Japan for a long time. So I would just kind of linger around the McDonald's in Shibuya and, you know, then every once in a while I'd open up my DS and be like, oh, look, I got like three hits in 5 seconds. It was fantastic. It was just a great, you know, kind of a very fleeting moment in time that there's no comparison now, and there doesn't need to be because, you know, internet Wi-Fi is just, it's
not quite as novel
now.
No,
everyone has it, so you don't need to go to a special destination for it. But at the time, that was something innovative and cool that they did, and much better than the DS dongle that they released. That was you could plug into your computer, and it was terrible.
It was so awful.
Absolutely awful.
I remember actually, Dragon Quest IX came out in North America around the same time that Otakon happened that year. And so everyone took Dragon Quest, because we're all a bunch of nerds, it's a nerd convention, everyone took their DS and Dragon Quest IX to Otakon, and my pub just was just this really fun, lively place because of it. That was actually a very good year. And maps, so many maps.
Yeah, PAX West was the same. The Hanta Lounge was just people hanging out on beanbag chairs and trading Dragon Quest maps.
Yep.
There was a quite obscure game called Treasure World. It was barely a game that sort of used the Wi-Fi in a way I thought was quite novel, where you would have this kind of, you would on this uninhabited sort of world, it's uninhabited, you'd run into someone immediately. And the whole game was based on identifying different Wi-Fi signals that would then grant you treasures. So what you would do is you would close the DS. I would set it on the top, like the dash of the car, and drive around to random places and try and find the place. Every time you'd go and you'd hit a new Wi-Fi connection, it would like ding, and you'd be like, "Oh, I've got a treasure!" And then you'd get home and you'd open it, and it would just be like, "You've unlocked 104 completely random things that don't do anything." And for some reason, that completely just had me for like a month. Just I couldn't not be playing that at any point. Wherever I went, I'm like, I've got to take Treasure World. I need to get these treasures. And I thought that was wonderful. I wish they would do something new like that, really.
I just remember the McDonald's Wi-Fi like hotspots just being super fussy, because we didn't have Wi-Fi at home, but the McDonald's around the corner did. So I remember taking my DS up there once Mario Kart came out to test it out. And I swear I must have spent like 20 minutes trying to get that stupid thing to connect. I don't even remember if I ever did. I think I ended up just going home out and buying a router.
Play Mario Kart by myself.
But I liked the concept. And
back then, like, a strange thing about Wi-Fi connections back then is that when people set them up, they usually weren't set private by default. So you could go around stealing other people's Wi-Fi signals, which I did a lot.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to imagine a time before Wi-Fi or even like LTE was prominent, but there was a time. There was a time. As Guns N' Roses was.
think the only other thing I used the Wi-Fi for was downloading the new puzzles for the Layton games. There was a new puzzle, I think, one per day for like...
Oh, that's right.
I think like a year. They did a lot of those puzzles. And I think they're all gone now. I don't think you can get them.
Probably
I mean, obviously there are hacks and there is thieving. But even then, I think they were actually legitimately downloads and not just unlock keys. So they're gone. It's a real shame. There were some good puzzles on there.
Yeah, Nintendo teamed up with GameSpy Technologies to do the infrastructure for the DS, and I don't think GameSpy Technologies is with us anymore.
No, they
and the Nintendo DS shut down its Wi-Fi support years ago, which was, you know, one of the, I would say, the long-term weaknesses of the system is that there is a lot of material that's just not... It's just not available to access anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, if you, you know, those weekly downloads for Dragon Quest, you would have to set up some sort of, like, fake dummy server or something and basically just sort of work your way around it. And that's hardly the only game for which that's the case. That's just kind of universal. So, yeah, that's a big disappointment and undermines the legacy of the system to a degree, I would say.
It had it might have been mentioned and I missed it, but it had like Netscape, didn't it? It was like
a terrible web browser.
Yeah. Wasn't it Opera?
Oh yeah, it might have been Opera. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish it was Netscape.
Yeah, it did not work very well.
I had a friend who bought it and they returned it.
It also didn't it have the Play on Media Player, but only in Japan, which had originally debuted with Game Boy Advance. It was like
basically
a cart you put in. And you could put an SD card in it, I believe, and play back, you know, half an hour of music or like 5 minutes of super compressed video. It wasn't quite that limited, but I bought one of those for Game Boy Micro and was like, whoa, this is extraordinarily bad. They definitely had ambitions with that, but it was just... Not quite there.
You did get like some sort of intro FMV, not FMVs, that's a stupid term, but you know what I mean. But they never really followed up on the promise of, for example, GB Game Boy Advance video, like where you could watch like a bit of Shrek.
Or watch three episodes of
SpongeBob.
Oh, no, not even three. You get two and you'd like it.
Like the size of like 6 pixels.
Yeah. One episode of Sonic X that sounds like shit because of the big crush.
Game Boy Advance.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Sonic X. How would you know?
Sonic X.
If you're a Sonic fan, then everything is perfect, so be quiet. I'm kidding.
Jeremy, if we're talking about a DS cartridge that has this SD card inside, I suppose it's time to make a dark segue and talk about the R4.
Oh, boy.
Oh.
Because
the death knell.
Yeah.
The death sentence.
I remember the day when I found out that existed. Jesus.
That became a thing, again, much like, you know, we talk about how the system reached a huge audience. You know, I don't think I've ever before or since had my wife come to me and talk about how easy it is to pirate a video game. But when we were all in on the DS, she was like, oh, hey, I have someone at work. You just go and buy this thing and you can play as many games as you want. I was like, oh, really? You know? And it was just, that's the level of, you know, that's the level of outreach that the R4 reached, you know, here in Japan, to the point that Nintendo had to actively sue a bunch of people and it became a big court case. And I believe the Japanese term was Majikon, like magic controller. But yeah, they weren't all called R4s, but R4 was the most popular one. And it was just... Yeah. It was so easily available for so many years until, you know, a heavy crackdown, which I wrote about for Wired, I want to say, in maybe 2012. But, yeah, it is funny how the DS was super big, and then all of a sudden the floodgates opened for pirates, and then all of a sudden no one bought DS games anymore, except for, you know, a very small minority of people.
Although I have to, I mean, I remember when I found out that existed because I'd never heard of a flash cart or flash cards. I mean, I'd emulated on a PC, you know, with a friggin' keyboard. But like, I went to a friend's house and he'd bought, I think it was called a Supercard DS1. I don't know why I said I think. I know it was that. And he's got games, Order of Ecclesia just come out, and Kirby Superstar Ultra was on there. And those are games that you could buy in Europe if you had some kind of frigging divining rod and you could find one of the 300 copies that they bothered bringing over. And I was just like, you must tell me where you bought this, and you must tell me now, or I will murder you where you stand. And I did end up getting a DS1 and playing not just a lot of DS games on it, because I'd already bought a bunch. I mean, to be honest, by the time I got mine, it wasn't end of life, but it was end of, you know, good. All the really cool stuff had come out already, but there was a lot of cool things you could do with that thing, like play them for emulators, like NES games, not really SNES, but Mega Drive worked for some reason, and I played a lot of Mega Drive on there, and it just almost gave it kind of a new lease of life. Because, I mean, I'm one of those guys who thinks, like, for me, without, like, piracy, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have heard of half of these games, and I wouldn't have then bought them when they got re-released, but I know I'm in a minority, because a lot of people just want to play free games. And, you know, so did I at that time. I can't pretend otherwise. And the fact that it was so easy as you said, Jeremy, a death sentence. That was probably my favorite DS pun today so far. But I remember I was with my ex and sort of the kids, the cousins around, and every single one of them had R4s. And you could just go down the town and buy one from the shop. They were just like, there were like signs in the window, like hundreds of DS games on one cart, £50, come and buy it. You know, just rinsing them. It was crazy.
Yeah, I feel like the R4 really is what wiped out a lot of the really weird niche DS releases. Because I remember, you know, when they localized Game Center CX, the first one, that game came out, what, 2009, 2010? And the R4 was very prolific by that point. And I remember reading that they weren't selling any of these copies of this game, so they weren't going to bother with the sequel. And I'm like, oh, well.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Of course, now I have to use an R4 if I want to play the sequel on my DS, because that's how I get the localized translation that someone did. But deny me getting to play it originally.
I wonder if now that the way the audience has sort of changed, though it's incredibly easy to pirate Switch games, but you shouldn't, obviously. For niche games, if the audience is sort of already there, if they're that niche, then I do wonder if that would have been a major factor. I mean, something like Retro Game Challenge, as they called it, that we never got that in Europe, so the only way I got to play that was through an R4. And if I'd seen that on the shelves, you can bet I would have bought it. But I do wonder if it is I just wonder exactly what effect it had and on who and how that's carried forward, I suppose. It's the fact that you could just go out to the high street and buy one is crazy to think about.
You are the R4 of this podcast. No, I agree. It was definitely a bad turn of events for the platform, because it really just sort of between that and the launch of smartphones that were competitive with the DS and, you know, much more powerful, it really put a crimp in the market. And I specifically remember that right around the time the R4 blew up, the publisher Atlas had really gone all in on localizing a bunch of niche RPGs for the DS, really like weird off the wall stuff. And they were taking this big gamble, but like, you know, it was the golden age. Everything would just explode in popularity if you put it out in reach of people, because tens of millions of people own DSs. So it was like, oh gosh, what was it? Steel Princess and My World, My Way and few of these other games. Like, just, you know, really, really things that you can't imagine having been localized even 5 years before. And they said, we're going to do it. And they took a bath.
Too bad.
Sega owns Atlas now, and I'm pretty sure that's why.
Oh no, that's too bad.
It was. I mean, they had their Persona games to keep them going. They were like, this PlayStation 2 platform has been dead for 5 years. Let's put Persona 4 out. That seems like a good idea, and it worked for them. So okay, you know. But this was not one of their better choices. So sorry, Atlas USA. You deserved better.
Atlas, thank you for bringing Atlas brought us Steel a lot Princess. Of weird stuff on the DS. Like, that was when we got Etrian Odyssey. We got, like, I think they brought out Strange Journey and Radiant mm-hmm. Historia. The first one, the original, was on there as well. Yeah. There's just some really good, weird games that, I guess the R4 just kind of gobbled everything up.
What was that insanely cool first-person dungeon crawly thing? Dark Spire, was that it?
Oh, the Dark Spire, yeah.
That was really sick. I love that. Yeah, and again, I played it on the R4. Sorry, Nintendo. Sorry, Atlas.
That game is now worth hundreds of dollars because no one bought it, so it's become extremely rare.
Thanks,
but
R4.
I guess you can play for free on R4.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even that, like, flashcards have become sort of a way of life, not for current-day systems, but for classic systems, things like the EverDrive have built on what you had with R4 with greater capabilities, and they can do amazing things. And I am not shy about saying that I use EverDrives for my work because some of those games that I cover are very expensive, and also it's just super difficult to keep track of hundreds and hundreds of cartridges. So thank God for the EverDrives. But those aren't crushing a modern business. Like, no one is making money selling NES, you know, or Super NES games aside from, like, people making new stuff, and that's fine. So I don't feel like putting Little Samson on an EverDrive is quite the same as putting My World My Way on an R4.
It was the same for the PSP, right? That was a huge piracy issue as well, because that thing is about as secure as, like, a hole in the ground. Like,
no, I mean, that thing was hacked right away. I never get tired of telling the story of Chris Kohler at E3 meeting with Shigeru Miyamoto about something unrelated, and then just whipping out a PSP. Like, it had been out for, you know, 6 months, and saying, hey, do you know about this? And he plays Super Mario Brothers on a PSP with an emulator.
Oh, my God.
And, like, the audacity to show Shigeru Miyamoto a pirated copy of Super Mario Brothers is one thing. Like, that's... God bless Chris Kohler and his audacity. But also, just, like, you know, right away... It showed the challenges that Sony was going to be facing. Although, PSP did really well for itself.
Is that better or worse than showing him the dick? Which is worse?
A PSP with a dick on it.
I think Miyamoto was having a hard time in the 2000s at these events.
He was just recovering from the dung thing, and then someone shows him that. It's just like, I'm not making Pikmin 3 for another
10
years.
That's why we got Wii Fit, because he was like, I need to work off all this stress. I got to get in shape. I got to get some endorphins going, because these games journalists are, God, I hate them. American game journalists.
I think that may have been
going to kill me.
What sent him temporarily insane and got us, like, Star Fox Guard and all that.
Star Fox, why?
Wii music.
No, we don't talk about the Wii U, at least not this episode.
Okay, sorry.
So how did Miyamoto react to seeing that?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't there.
Oh, darn.
Like I said, it's not really my story to tell.
He said, wow, that's really cool. I'm going to put that on my PSP when I get home.
I need to get one of these for myself. Hot damn. I remember Super Mario Brothers. That was good times.
I mean, to be fair, you know, he did invent, like, Mario and Zelda and, you know, Pikmin, but what has he done lately, let's face it? It's kind of, you know, whatever.
Isn't he retired?
I don't know, maybe he bought an R4. Maybe he's busy catching up on the DS.
Sorry, one of my favorite things to do is to undermine the legacy of Shigeru Miyamoto for no reason. All right.
That's a good way to piss people off.
It is, yeah.
Bastard.
I forgot I wasn't on Twitter.
We are getting on close to the 2-hour mark and close to the midnight mark for Diamond over there in Japan. So rather than drag this out too much longer, why don't we put this to rest before we talk more about penises or Nazis? Both.
I want
any final thoughts on the Nintendo DS? In warm memories, fuzzy thoughts, any sort of DS related things you want to share?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of dipped my toe in the story earlier, but basically, when the DS Lite came out specifically, and I bought that, it sort of reignited my love for video games. It also sort of showed me that, you know, as much as there was a, I'm not gonna call it a safe space, but there was a haven there for newish games or games that had an old flavor to them, or at least a simplistic 2D style, which meant I had a lot more games I could suddenly play, and I was very excited for that. Although at the same time, I also saw that as much as those games were excited me, I also realized that, oh geez, there are a lot of exciting games that are also now on the PS3 and the Xbox 360, and geez, I guess I need to get one of those consoles now too. So in a way, it also led me back down a deep slide into, you know, buying lots of video game equipment over and over again. You know, probably too much.
Back into sin.
Yeah, but I think I'm better for it. I think I am. I'm happier knowing that there is indeed a wide variety of video games. Like, before that, I was like basically giving up. It's like, oh geez, there's no more games for me. It's like, no, there's always games for me. And the DS was a viable market for those games for me for a couple of years there, and I'm grateful that it showed me the light. And well, I don't exactly miss the DS today because there's so many other ways to do it. I do kind of miss that that free for all. Like, it involved big companies. Like, yeah, like as Jeremy said before, like, this obviously people are always going to make weird ass games. Like, that's never going to go away. But, you know, how often does Nintendo make weird ass games these days? Not that many. Not that many weird ass Nintendo games. Weird Nintendo is hard to come by. You know, like, we're recording this days before they, you know, they released a Zelda game where Zelda is playable. Like, that's what counts for weird Nintendo these days. Like, oh, what if we put Zelda in the Zelda game? So, you know, there's no more Owendons from Nintendo anymore.
I guess maybe we need a Nintendo that's scrabbling to get back on top than a Nintendo that's comfortably sitting on top, I guess. I mean, for me, I've already said my piece about the DS, but I'm going to use this space to just say to everyone who owns a DS or is thinking about owning a DS, you need to buy Bangaio Spirits, you need to buy Bomberman 2, it's better than you think it is, okay, it's an awesome game, and you need to buy Final Fantasy XII Revenant Wings. That's it. That's all I'm going to say. Thanks. It's a great system. I'm slightly emotional talking about it because it was that important to me, so cheers.
Yeah, for me, the DS is synonymous with a really great time in my life. You know, working at 1UP was definitely stressful, but the period that was kind of the DS's heyday was overall a really good, happy time where I got to meet lots of great game developers, traveled to interesting places, and my DS was always with me wherever I traveled. And just, you know, I was always playing it at home, on the go, at the office, just, you know, experiencing all kinds of games. The library is so vast and so varied that it really encompasses every kind of gaming experience you could imagine. And, you know, to a degree, the Switch is that way, but there's just something less friendly and fun about the Switch. It's a great system, don't get me wrong, and it's been an amazing success for Nintendo. I think it has eclipsed DS's sales at this point. But there was just something kind of, you know, redolent of that vanishing age of game design and game thinking that really kind of came to a head with the DS. And, you know, like we said, I guess a few months ago now, with Dreamcast, it just represented something about video games that you don't see anymore. And I really value that. And it makes the DS, you know, one of my all-time favorite systems. I'd put it in, like, the top 2-3. It's right up there, and it has so many amazing games. It's just, you know, if for some reason you're listening to this podcast and you've never played a DS, go and find one, and my God, you have an amazing experience ahead of you. So much to discover, and you'll probably find games that are really great and I didn't even know about because there were thousands of games made for DS, and so many of those never made it to the US. Like, if you start digging into the import stuff, you're going to find garbage, just piles and piles of garbage. But within that garbage, you're going to find genuine treasure, like truly great games that no one in the West is talking about. No one knows about here, because who could possibly make it through the DS library in its entirety? No one. No one could. Not even the people who were playing the games to review them or to ESRB rate them or whatever. Like, it's just It's too monumental a task for a single human.
Yeah, I mainly agree. For me, the DS was like kind of my entry into games writing. I mentioned about.com, of course, 1UP.com. And I also did a lot of writing for GamePro around that time. And I think I did some consultation as well. But yeah, I have like games like Dragonology, which was like more of a studying dragons with as an encyclopedia. And I had like Prince Caspian, the Narnia game that came out. It was like, I can't remember which RPG it aped, but it was just one of those licensed games that apes another system and does okay for it. So yeah, it was just like weird stuff like that. Like, you're not going to find a Prince Caspian like Switch game. It's just not going to happen. And yeah, that was also a really good time for games journalism, because even though like we were still paid like garbage, we had freedom to write about whatever we wanted pretty much. There was no SEO. There is no Google eating everything and turning you into nothing. It's just, I wrote about the DS a lot. I wrote about the games I played. And yeah, it was just a good time for games. It was a good time for games writing as well.
Yeah, for me, the DS really hit at a very transitional period in my life. You know, I was in college and then I graduated and then there was a massive, you know, crushing recession that left me with not a lot of money and a lot of free time, and the DS was there to provide through all of that. Excuse me. And like you said, there was so much interesting, weird stuff on there. I remember, like, there was the Aliens Infestation game that wasn't even really promoting any particular movie. It was just like, what if we made a Metroid-style game with aliens? Here we go. Go nuts. And it was fantastic. That was a great experience. You know, the funky touchscreen, like, demo games. They were very, like, thin, but they were interesting. They were unique. They weren't something you really had seen a lot of recently, and outside of, like, Newgrounds and... They definitely had better production than a Newgrounds game. So, overall, I really like that package, the DS in general. Not even the 3DS, I felt, really nailed the same vibes as the original unit. And I'm glad I was there for it.
Exactly, yeah.
So, in summary, Nintendo DS doesn't suck.
Yep.
Good cap.
So, okay, yeah, anyway, it's 20 years old. That's crazy. We're also 20 years old, plus however other many years were on there when the DS came out. Yeah, wow. Thanks for taking the time on this Sunday morning and or evening or afternoon, depending on your time zone, to talk about the DS with me. This is a patron-exclusive episode, so we don't need to give our bona fides and where you can find Retronauts, because those who are listening to this podcast already know, and we thank you for your support, but I would like to encourage everyone to tell us where we can find your various online shenanigans and support your work. I'll go first. You can find me on the internet. Yes, as Jeremy Parrish. It's amazing. I have a YouTube channel, and right now I would like to promote an actual thing you can buy, which is a book called The NES Era Volume 2, NES and the Console Revolution, which is available for pre-order at limitedrungames.com through November 21st or 24th. And that is a 12 by 12 inch coffee table book, photography, text, screenshots about every American console game released from the time the NES launched in October 1985 through the end of 1987. It's not just NES games. It's Master System, Atari 2600, Atari 5200, Atari 7800, Atari XE Game System, Mattel and Television, and was there anything else? No, I think that was it. But it's all those systems in their chronological order, so the overall effect of that book should be like, you know, you open up the pages and flip through, and it's like seeing what you could buy at any given time on the walls of an electronics shop, which will help you hopefully better understand like what it was like to be a kid buying video games in the mid-80s, but also why Nintendo did so well and why, you know, what was interesting about Sega Master System and were the kids who had Atari 2600s really that unfortunate? Were there good things out there for it still? Yes. That's the thing we want to explore in this. I want to explore Solaris, this book. Solaris. So check it out. The NES Era, Volume 2. That's my pitch for my stuff. Nadia, what about you?
I am Nadia Oxford. Of course, I am on Retronauts. I have episodes here, but also for the main part, I am on Axe of the Blood God. I'm a co-host. We cover RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. You can support us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. I also put up my personal writing and some of my preserved old games writing over at patreon.com/Nadia Oxford. If you just want to kind of help me have, like, I have, like, for example, game articles from, like, 2010, which I find, I kind of clean them up, I put them up, and then I lock them behind a dollar, at least, because it's just, like, I don't want AI to profit off me any more than it already has.
Understandable. Diamond?
You can find my website. It's fightclub.me. F-E-I-T, that's my last name. C-L-U-B, that's an English word you know, .me, fightclub.me. So, yeah, you can find my other stuff on there, although most of my stuff's for Retronauts these days, but, you know, it's not just Retronauts for me, there's other things. I have a broad personal life, you know, I don't want to boast, but, you know, I've got things going on. I'm a happening person.
I'm so jealous.
Stuart, what about you?
Mostly you can find me on Retronauts doing this stuff that I do here, you know, I also did a book called All Games Are Good, which is about how every game ever made is good. And if you disagree, I'm afraid that you'll have to read the book to find out why you're incorrect. But mostly it's just all the stuff that I played or was interested in growing up with my incredibly wrong, incorrect... Oh, there's Diamond's got a copy of it. Thank you, Diamond. Well done. I'm very proud of you. all the things that I grew up playing that most books wouldn't bother covering because they are licensed games or bizarre sort of cartoony games or games deemed as kiddie or just odd sort of mascot games, but it's much broader than that. There's a lot of stuff in there and there's a lot of fun, and it's on limited run games in hardback, and I believe it's in paperback on Amazon. It could be wrong about that. It's one or the other, and you should go and buy it. That's immediately correct. It's extremely good, and also it's so heavy set that you could kill your enemies with it, and that's always that was the main thing that I specified when I was initially pitching it.
It must kill people.
Yes. If the text doesn't do it, then the corner will.
Stuart, what is good?
What is
good? Crush your enemies with a copy of All Games Are Good.
Yeah, what is good? Killing people with books and all games. Thank you.
Kevin, finally, wrap it up for us.
So you can find my book, Atari Archive Volume 1, on Limited Run Games and on Amazon. And that is about the first few years of the Atari 2600's life. Another system with a lot of weird experimental games that have since become sort of standards in terms of mechanics and all sorts of fun stuff. So you can learn about their origins there. And if you're interested and not sure about that, I have a YouTube channel, Atari Archive, that is Patreon supported under the same name, that has been running for several years now and has gotten several years into the system's life. And I'm also on Blue Sky at Ubersaurus.
All right, and that wraps it up for this episode. Thanks, everyone, for participating, who is here participating. Thanks, everyone, for listening, who is out there listening. We will be back on Monday with a regular episode, and again in 2 weeks with another patron-exclusive episode. But in the meantime, you can play some Nintendo DS games, because that is what is good and fun.